Shalom once again, and welcome to the Wild Branch Ministry. We are in the middle of a discussion, or series, if you will, of teaching concerning the general subject of relationships. We are going and have been talking about relationships, biblical, of course, between males and females, or men and women, and relationships between husbands and wives, as they are ordained by God from the very beginning. We are also going to be talking about divorce and remarriage and that subject. And we've also talked about women and their position and responsibilities within, quote, the congregation or the assemblies. We've also talked about that. However, on this tape, I want to focus on something that on the outset or on the surface may seem irrelevant, but it's one of those subjects that really gets down to the meat and the nitty-gritty of everyday life and in dealing with each other. Because you and I, we can go to conferences and we can listen to tapes and we can get all kinds of study material and watch videos. And we can all, of course, be blessed with good spiritual meaty teaching concerning theology and doctrine, especially maybe concerning eschatology, things in the future and so forth. But the reality, I must say, is that after we put the book down or turn off the tape or the video, or after we come home from the conference or the seminars, we have to face with the day-to-day reality of relationships between our children, our spouses, our friends, our co-workers, our quote-unquote Christian brothers and sisters, and of course now, even though there's always going to be a struggle, daily struggle concerning those relationships, now we have to deal with fighting and fussing even among the Messianic brethren. And that is something that has tremendously disappointed me, especially in the past 6 months to a year, is to see all the, quote, in-house fighting between each other over what seems most of the time to be particular subjects. It seems like the fighting is always subject-oriented. There are certain things that we all take sides and go to our corners on in this Messianic movement. And of course, the same is true of all religions. We see that happening even in Islam today as we watch what's going on in the news. We see factions even with Islam in which they disagree one with another. But the truth, my friends, is that that not ought be. And that's not the way God designed it, and especially concerning these last days. The reality is we have to deal with personalities and relationships. And many times our spiritual life and our spiritual connection with God is many times directly related with how things are going in this, you know, physical earthly life here. A bad relationship between a husband and a wife can severely curtail your spiritual, if I can use these words, I'm just throwing around some off-coded terms, spiritual life, meaning our deep-seated relationship with the God of creation. And we all have to admit that that is true. And many times things that are going on in our everyday relationships, a fight with a child, not getting along with the parents or the wife, tension at work with the bosses, and tension in your relationship, your community relationship with the other quote-unquote churches within the community. These can affect our walk with God. And of course, it's equally true that our walk with God is supposed to affect our relationship with all these same people in our communities and families and workplaces and so forth. And so, as you can see, this is a very symbiotic relationship that we've entered into. Many times you'll find that our problems with other brethren sometimes boil down to, especially if you know them well, sometimes boil down to a difference in personalities, and so a misperception in what they're trying to say develops within these different ways that, when I say personalities, what we're boiling it down to is different ways of reacting and acting in given equal situations. You got a set of circumstances that happen, And if people with the four different personalities describe that same situation, they all describe it differently, even though they're looking at the same situation. And many times, that's what's happening with our miscommunication among the brethren. It's just bad communication. And sometimes we attribute that to, you know, the personality or the way that the other person is presenting his side, or the way the other person is reacting to you in your presentation. Now, the same is true, because I want to equate these things, the same is true in our marriage relationships as well. Many times I've sat and listened to couples who are separating or having marriage problems, and they begin to see each other as personally attacking each other and so forth. And really, many times it's just a lack of communication. And I also might add, not that I'm trying to overdo this short little, what will mostly be fun, study on personalities, but I have had comments from many people, even across this country, that have heard the live presentations of this, that it has helped their marriage, because they began to see and understand that their spouse wasn't acting that way or reacting that way because they all of a sudden don't like them or don't want to be around them or despise them, but because they've finally realized that this is part of their built-in personality. This is the way they react to things. And when you begin to accept that, and at the same time, each person begins to work on the negative aspects of their personality and relationship, that's when things begin to bloom and get much better. Understanding each other's built-in personalities helps us, as I said, to see that he or she, the other spouse, is not purposely doing this to me. And when you see this in your spouses, then you can begin to see this happening in your other relationships as well. Oh, well, maybe that guy or that girl doesn't really feel this way. Maybe they act like that because they can't help it. That's part of their built-in personality. There are some aspects of personality that, or the way we react to things, that it has nothing to do with our personality so much, but also has to do with whether we're male or female. And we talked a little bit about this in the tape on male and female relationships. Some things, basically all men act that way. And there's some things in basically all women act that way. And of course, obviously, there's anecdotal evidence and exceptions to these rules. But basically, men, as I said, are going to act and react in situations based on the fact that they are very goal-oriented people. And women are going to react, or in this case, your spouse, if it's a marriage or if it's a woman co-worker, women are going to react in such a way that's oriented toward the process, because they're process-oriented. Now, we also need, someone might ask, well, why is this important? Well, it's important for two reasons. One, because the reality of our life is in our day-to-day activity. That's the real realities in our life. As I said, it's good to understand eschatology and things and the prophetic future and so forth, but one reason for learning this is to be able to get along in this life right now. The other reason, of course, is there's going to be a time soon, I pray and hope, but it's in God's time, it's in the Father's time, when we all, as brothers and sisters in the Messiah, will be together, and we will and must get along in this coming greater exodus, or this time when we're all going to be together, taken care of by God Himself. And we got to get away from this past Christian notion that somehow, and this is the way I was brought up in Christian teaching, that you're saved now, okay? And so now we're just all kind of trudging through this life the best we can until the Lord raptures us and takes us out of this messy earth that we're in. And somehow we get the idea through this kind of teaching that God is going to change us all when that time comes, that we're just going to react negatively in relationships here on earth, but one day God is going to rapture us, and all of a sudden we'll just love the brethren. God will just zap us with this love, and because we have this new existence in the Messiah in the future, that it's kind of fuzzy. The future is always kind of fuzzy in your mind. You know, it's not real clear and focused like it is the real life today, and so we get false impressions of what it's going to be like. The truth is that we need to learn to get together and get along with each other now. And I'm going to show that through Scripture in a few minutes. Because the truth is, the resurrection that's coming is a bodily resurrection. The transformation that is yet future is the bodily transformation. The scriptures are clear in Romans chapter 11. Now is the time when you transform your mind. Now is the time when we have to change our way of thinking and think like the Messiah and work and act and perform like the Messiah. Not some fuzzy time in the future, but now is when our minds would be transformed. That's what the scriptures teach us. Now, it's not by coincidence that before many of the well-known prophecies of the future of the body and the Messiah, we are warned, or there's a serious discussion given about either love, loving the brethren, being one, and unity. These are all subjects that precede a lot of popular teaching in the scriptures on the coming of the Messiah. For example, in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, for example, we're all aware of that. Then in chapter 4, verses 13 through 18, we have the famous, "The Lord himself shall descend from heaven with a shout and with the voice of an archangel and with the trump of God, and the dead in Messiah shall rise first. And then we who are alive," let's see, how does it go? What "and remain shall be caught up together with him in the clouds." That's what it teaches. And so all of us are familiar with these teachings on what's going to happen to the faithful, excuse me, in Messiah. But there are 12 verses that precede that, in which I will quote. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, it says, "Furthermore, then we beseech you, brethren, and exhort you by Adonai Yeshua, that as ye have received of us how ye ought to walk and to please God, so ye would abound more and more." You find out consistently through Scripture that what precedes eschatological passages is warnings concerning obeying God and loving your brethren. That's the two principal warnings before any discussions of the future, whether it be by the Messiah, whether it be in the Tanakh. I'm just giving you some examples here that we're all familiar with, or whether it be in the epistles with Paul. As a matter of fact, even before the Messiah gets in, the very first church he talks about in the book of the Revelation, or Hid Galut, he warns us, he warns some that they have left what? Their first love. That's the very first church he warns, Kahal. You have left your first love. Go back to your first love, using a marriage relationship to describe something that has happened within his people. So he goes on in verse 2 in 1 Thessalonians 4, and he says, "For you know what commandments we gave you by Adonai Yeshua. For this is the will of God, even your sanctification, that you should abstain from fornication, that every one of you should know how to possess his vessel in sanctification and honor, not in the lust of sensuality, even as the Gentiles who know not God, that no man go beyond and defraud his brother in any manner, because Yahweh is the avenger of all such, as we also have been forewarned you and have testified. For God hath not called us unto uncleanness, but unto holiness." And of course, the only thing provided in Scripture that's the guideline for holiness is Torah. The words and commandments and instruction and ordinances and statutes of God. Then he goes on and says, "He therefore that despises not man, but God, who has also given us his Ruach HaKodesh." Verse 9, "But as touching brotherly love, you need not that I write unto you, for ye yourselves are taught of God." Where? Well, the book of Leviticus is one, Vayikra, "that you should love one another. And indeed, ye do it toward all the brethren who are in Macedonia. But we beseech you, brethren, that you increase more and more. You are to be quiet, do your own business, work with your own hands, walk honestly, and then you are to lack nothing." Now, this is the warning that's given in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 1 through 12, before he even discusses anything in the future. Now, it's also not a coincidence to me that in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, which we were all told that that we're going to be shown a mystery, and that we shall not all sleep, but we'll all be changed, and in the moment of a twinkling of an eye at the last trump, for the trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible, and we shall all be changed. And all this is used by great eschatological minds to teach of something in the future. But Paul, Shaul, has preceded 1 Corinthians 15 with 1 Corinthians 11, 12, 13, and 14. And I didn't bother to take this any further back, but it seems evident that when you read chapter 11, of course, Shaul is warning us of our attitude toward each other and to at Pesach, at sitting down to the Passover meal. And sharing that. So first we're given a warning in 1 Corinthians chapter 11 about how we are to behave when it comes to that meal. Then we are told in 1 Corinthians chapter 12 another insight into the body, that the body has many members, but there is only one body. And then, of course, we know 1 Corinthians chapter 13 is the famous love chapter, where Paul tells us the definition of what love is, and faith and charity and so forth. And then in 1 Corinthians 14, the very first words are, follow after love. That's the very first words. Some of the words we forget when we're all fussing and fighting over the tongues issue or whatever, we forget. Follow after love. And of course, the last verse in 1 Corinthians 14, before we get into the 1 Corinthians 15 eschatological chapter of the resurrection, we are told, let all things be done decently and in order. Now, another place that I would like to bring up is the book of the Revelation, or Hid Kalut. And we all are familiar enough with prophecy to know that there would be no prophecy teaching complete without, you know, some sort of teaching out of the book of the Revelation. And of course, we know that most of the things that are said in there are drawn right, as dare I say, all the things that are said in there are drawn right out of the prophecies in the Tanakh. But before we are given this great revelation, we have the epistles of John and Jude preceding that. And we all know that the first epistle of John is distinctly all about love and keeping the commandments. 1 Yochanan chapter 2, verse 3 and 4 and 5. I'll read all four of those, three of those. And by this, we do know that we know him if we keep his commandments. He that says, I know him, and does not keep his commandments, he's a liar, and the truth is not in him. But whosoever keeps his word, in him verily is the love of God perfected. By this know we that we are all in him. And then he goes down to verse 11, and he says, verse 9 through 11, he says, he that says he is in the light and hates his brother is in darkness even till now. He that loves his brother abides in the light, and there is no occasion of stumbling in him. But he that hateth his brother is in darkness and walks in darkness and knows not where he goes, because darkness has blinded his eyes. He's one of those, he falls in the category of the one of those of the sons of the night in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, who know not the words of God, who know not Torah. The sons of night are the one who have not walking according to Torah. Why do I say that? Because Torah teaches you how to love your brother. That's what it teaches you. And so it is no coincidence that there, let me read just a couple of others. 1 John chapter 4, verse 7 says, beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God, and everyone that loves is born of God and knows God. 11 and 12, beloved, if God so loved us, we ought also to love one another. No man has seen God at any time. If we love one another, God dwells in us, and in his love is perfected in us. And so combine that with Jude 20 through 23, the last part of this short book, says, but ye, beloved, build up yourselves on your most holy faith, praying in the Ruach HaKodesh. Keep yourselves in the love of God, looking for the mercy of Adonai Yeshua the Messiah unto eternal life. He says, and of some have compassion, making a difference, and others save with fear, pulling them out of the fire, hating even the garment spotted by the flesh. Not the person, but the activity in the garment spotted by the flesh. And so, it is quite evident to me that having unity among each other, I believe, as I hope I showed in another part of this study, begins with the very first relationship that God gives mankind, and that is between the husband and the wife. And I believe when there is a good, healthy relationship between the husband and wife, then there is a good, healthy relationship between the father and mother and the children. And when there's a good, healthy relationship between those two, then those children go out and have good, healthy relationships with their brethren. And I believe this is the pattern that's set forth in the very first chapters of Bereshit. Very first chapters of Bereshit. The way our spouse, as I said before, behaves or reacts to situations or how they respond to instructions or needs from the other spouse is primarily, I'm going to suggest, based on these four personalities. Many times, spouses just end up not talking to each other at all because we develop these relationship calluses and personality calluses on it. We already know what they're going to say. You know, I'm not going to say that or do that. I already know what the reaction is going to be. And so many times we avoid having serious communication among one another. And of course, it's only through communication between a husband and wife that you know, the household is run efficiently and things operate in a godly way, the way they're supposed to. Now, I also want to bring up, before we get into this, that these four, if you have four people reacting to the same set of circumstances, although they all react or act differently given the same set of circumstances, that is no reflection on their faith or their love and commitment to you or God. That's my focus in this. Because a situation arises in your home in which the two of you react differently or have different opinions on it, should not reflect on your love and commitment to each other. And the same is true that when a given situation many times happens within the body or with another brother or within ourselves that we react differently to, or we have a different opinion of, because some of us, as the cliche goes, see the glass half full and some see it half empty. Because of those kind of things, that does not reflect on that individual's commitment and faith to their God. Because they act or react differently to a set of circumstances, something that may happen among the other brethren or something that may happen in a congregational setting, that it's not specifically covered by Torah. One person thinks they ought to do this. Another person thinks they ought to do that. Consider that part of what we're trying to say here and don't conclude that they have a greater or lesser faith or commitment to God than you do or I do. I believe, and you can, you know, after you get done with this, you can go through and go through some of these biblical characters yourself and come to your own conclusion. But I believe that there is some evidence of the personalities of certain biblical characters. Having not going into the personalities yet, you may not know what recognize the terms yet, but Paul, I believe, for example, could have very well been had a very choleric kind of personality. Choleric personalities, let me go through them real fast, because the actual presentation is going to be the last half of this tape, and it's going to be live, a live presentation taken from a conference not too long ago. And so the actual presentation of these personalities, and we're going to have fun, my friends. Keep in mind that the object, this thing is live, and the object is not only to teach the personalities, but to have a little fun with them too, and maybe not take ourselves so seriously. So, you know, be prepared for perhaps even a little goofiness in this live presentation. But basically, people have four personalities, and each of these personalities have strengths and they have weaknesses. It's my opinion that quite possibly the Messiah himself was a 10, 10, 10, 10 in all the strengths. I believe Messiah was probably, this is only my guess, just my opinion, probably very balanced in all the strengths of every one of these personalities. I don't believe he had any of the weaknesses, but he had all the strengths that each one of these four personalities have. And it's only with all four of these kind of people, my friends, that's what makes the world go round. That's what, for those of you who are followers of the Messiah, we need desperately all four of these personalities within the body in order to make it flow. Okay. Now, there are some people who have a more choleric personality, while on the one hand, like Paul, I believe Paul the Apostle was that way, and I believe Moses became that way. I believe he started out phlegmatic, a little wishy-washy, but then had to be choleric because he's got to lead all these people. But the choleric personality, while on the other hand, is very bossy, okay, and sometimes unsympathetic and so forth, and they're argumentative people. on the one hand. On the other hand, they are great leaders and great administrators. And so we need people that lead and administrate, can take over a situation and put it in order and make something work. And of course, there's people like possibly Job, you know, or even Nathaniel sitting under a tree. I'm guessing that they were probably more melancholic type of people. Melancholic type of people were on one hand are very withdrawn, and they're very alienated from people, and they're easily depressed. Okay, and there's always something wrong with them on one hand, but on the other hand, they are the great geniuses of the world. They are the ones who possess, chart making and graph making abilities, and they're very organized people. And it's got to be a certain way, and they are the ones who turn out to be the Einsteins and the Van Cliburns and the Beethovens, so forth, of our society. Now, I also believe that more than likely, Moses was the kind of person that started out very phlegmatic. I believe he had to become a quick choleric, but very wishy-washy. Are you sure you want me? I don't think I can do this. Why don't you do this? Why don't you lead the people? Why don't you choose somebody over here? Me? You know, they on the one hand, phlegmatics are very wishy-washy, and you really can't pin them down to anything, and they really don't commit to one side or the other. I joke about the fact that they're, moderate Republicans or whatever, but they really don't take a side, and they kind of wait, wet their finger and stick it up and let the wind blow and kind of go wherever they want to go. On one hand, they're like that, but on the other hand, these are the friendly people. These are the ones who get along with everyone, and they're fun. They're good people to be around because they just, change suits and become what you are, and so they're good people to have around. And last, it would be the personality that I probably fall into. I think Peter was probably a sanguine type personality, because while on the one hand, sanguines are very scatterbrained, and they're very undisciplined and scatterbrained, and they're very forgetful. They forget things from one minute to the next. On the one hand, they're like that, but on the other hand, they're very animated. They'll be the first one to charge in. They're very outgoing and expressive. They're the first ones. When Messiah would say, "Who men think that I am?" Of course, the sanguine would be the first one to jump up and say, "Who you are?" And so, each of these personalities have very good strengths. And they also have weaknesses to go along with them. And the point of all these is to be able to recognize them in ourselves and work as best we can on the weaknesses and really highlight and accentuate the strengths. And whoever I'm speaking to now, whether you be male or female, you need to encourage this in your spouse. When you sit down and you take this test, and by the way, you may be able to, you can go on our website and you can contact us through email or phone call or whatever, and we'll be happy to send you one of these tests that you go through, because what you'll do is you'll take the test, it'll simply list strengths and weaknesses, and you'll have to choose between four. They'll give you four different kinds of strengths that are all closely related, and be four different kinds of weaknesses, and they'll do this in 40 different categories. And then when you're done, we will also give you the profile scoring sheet that will go along with this. And you can do this among yourselves or among your children. And when you begin to discover your strengths and your weaknesses that each one of you have, you can begin to boost each other in your strengths and help their strengths really shine. And, of course, be understanding and sympathetic about the weaknesses. And I can guarantee you this will help you out if you've never done anything like this in your marriage relationships. And my point, of course, in all of this is that we will begin to get along in a godly way between our husbands and wives, between our mothers and fathers and their children, and between each other. This is something that we have to make up and transform our minds to do. And as I said before, that's something that Rav Shaul taught us that we need to do now upon this earth. Because the truth is that once your spirit, that aspect of you that's breathed by God, has been renewed and you are made new, then you have a source from which to take your understanding of things, and that would be the area of your mind, because now you're taking your source right from God Himself. No longer are you are your attitudes and perspectives about life and other people taken from the world and magazines and TV and the media. But once you're born again, once you have the Spirit of God in you, now you can now, according to Romans chapter 2, you can, and 1 Corinthians chapter 2, you can take from the Spirit of God now. Because the natural man knows the things that are natural. We're given, all of us have a spirit. The Spirit of man teaches us things of the Spirit of man. And so that's why men, even if they're not born again, they're not people of God, can still invent great things, and they can still do good things, and they can still go to work, and they can still have families and children and so forth, and they can still build rockets and technology and so forth. God has given man a spirit separate from all the animals, separate from all the other aspects of his creation. That's how humans stand out from the rest of creation. That we have what's called a spirit, the spirit of man, and that allows us to be able to think and do and create and laugh and express emotions and build things and realize that things are wrong or things are right. These are things that man has that the animal kingdom and the rocks and the trees and hills do not have. And he's given us the ability to take. Now, once you've been born again and his spirit is one with yours, by the way, this is 1 Corinthians chapter 2, not Romans chapter 2, and your spirit is one with his, now you are open to receive from the Spirit of God. And when you do that, he promises that he will now transform your mind. And my friends, it is a fact, and I've taught this before, once your mind has been transformed and it's thinking differently, your body has to do what your mind tells it to do. So that's why theology is directly connected with behavior. Behavior. It ultimately results in behavior, because that oneness that you have with the Spirit of God is a seed that is planted. When you receive it, now you take things from the Spirit of God and not the spirit of man anymore, and you behave appropriately. So God has called us to get along with one another, to behave in a certain way, one toward another, to love each another and have unity one with another. And so I want to close with a passage that we're all familiar with. Before we get into the actual teaching, it's in Mizmor 133. You all are familiar with it. It says, "Behold how good and how pleasant it is for brethren to dwell together in unity." It's not just something we're commanded to do, but God says that when we do it, it's for our own good. We are going to experience something that's pleasant and beautiful to do among each other. And it will be like precious ointment upon your head that ran down upon the beard, even Aaron's beard that went down to the skirts of his garment. And it will be like the dew of Hermon and like the dew that descended upon the mountains of Zion. And there Yahweh commanded the blessing, even life forevermore. And so I hope as you listen to this live presentation that you will take away from it what I intended to be taken away from it. And that is for all of us to understand that many times the things that we do are just part of our personalities, and learn to live with it. And once you begin to accept it, then every situation that you are confronted with in your life between you and your spouse or you and your other brethren, I promise you will be seen in a different light. So I hope you enjoy this presentation. Okay, let's talk about personalities. I'm going to show you that I believe the four personalities. There was a man years and years ago, Hippocrates, what was his name? Or Hippocrates, depending upon how you want to say it, who used four Greek words that kind of describe fluids, different ways that fluids move, okay, to describe all of our personalities. And there may be six or seven, but he put it down to four. And it just so happens that, in my opinion, based upon the etymology and the verbal research of the four levels of interpretation, that I believe those four personalities happen to match the four levels of interpretation in Scripture: Peshat, Remez, Drash, and Sop. Okay? Because all four of those interpretive methods need to be used when you interpret the Scripture. Don't limit yourself to just one or two. That's the biggest problem I have with people. They discover some little thing, some neat thing about gematria or gematria, however you want to pronounce it. And next thing you know, they're searching for the soul in everything.
the heck with the Peshat and the literal. I don't want to know what's actually going to happen. I want to search these things. And next thing you know, I get floods of emails from people trying to find all these nifty little things. Don't use one to the exclusion of the other. The rabbis used to sit down and use those methods. They would always use Peshat first. Peshat was always first. When you read the seven churches in Asia in the book of Revelation, I believe all four of those methods apply to what's going on there, but the first one you use is the Peshat. The first thing you need to grasp is it was literally seven churches at that time. Don't go right to the Sod, okay? But use all four. And all four are needed in order to understand the Scripture in the same way that all four personalities are needed in the body. And we need to learn to deal with each other's personalities and realize that when someone does something not the way we would do it, they're not out to get you. Many times it's just their personality. It's just the way God designed them. The same with the men and the women. You need to see all our various personalities. Because again, the first thing Hasatan does is he attacks the marriage relationship. And the next thing he does is attack the children, Cain and Abel. And the next thing he does is attack the brethren, sons of God, daughters of men. You got the whole world corrupt. Okay, he follows that pattern. And the pattern in reverse is also true. Many times, the way a person is to other people in his life depends upon how his relationship was with his parents. And his relationship with his parents is sometimes predetermined by the relationship between the husband and the wife. So you start with that. The first ministry God gave you in a family relationship was your marriage. I really don't care to hear people say, even though they say it proudly, you know, the most important thing in our life is our kids. Better not be. Better not be. Most important thing better be you and your wife. And if you make that most important, the kids will take care of themselves, and then the relationship that you have with your other brethren will take care of yourself. But I can guarantee you can also always trace problems with each other back to husband and wife through the relationship that you had with your parents. I sat in counseling for years and listened to these things over and over, and you begin to see. It's like Dr. Laura. You know, she's funny and she's sometimes good because she's what? Seen about, you know, 50,000 people every year. And she sees this thing constantly coming at her. And so she's very wise. And she knows what she's doing. So there's four personalities that people basically fall into. I'm going to go through them real quick, and then we're going to do them one at a time. So Ephraim, don't put it up yet. There's the choleric. Choleric, I've heard that. I pronounce it choleric. Okay. Blunt, bold, in your face, take charge. They're leaders. They're very frank, and they're very controlling. Okay, now I'm going to give you good and bad for each one. Then you've got the phlegmatic. The phlegmatic I mentioned earlier is very easygoing, very friendly, very wishy-washy, moderate Republicans, but indecisive, okay? Really can't decide on things one way. They're really irritating sometimes, you know. Even though phlegmatics have lots of friends, you have to remember, if a person has, that everybody is their friend, really nobody's their friend. That's really the bottom line. But they're very friendly people, but they're very wishy-washy, you can never pin them. Then you've got the sanguines, that'd be me. Sanguines, we're the fun people, okay? We're the partiers, we're the ones that like to talk, we're the ones that like to tell stories, okay? We're the ones that always have to be in the limelight. We're the ones that you enter a party or into a room, they'll be the ones yakking the most, okay? They're very exuberant, they're very aggressive, they're very forward, but they're also very scatterbrained, and they forget a lot, and whatever it was I was going to say. But they're really goofy and scatterbrained, so they have a lot of negative things. Honey, I'm going to put these up on a screen if you're taking notes, and you can see them one at a time. And then you got the melancholies. The world could completely do without these people. But, no, that contradicts what I said earlier. We need the melancholies. The melancholies are very deep, they're very serious, they're the geniuses. They're the ones, they're the perfectionists, but they're very depressing to be around, for sure. So, let's go to the very first one, the sanguine.
There's no business like show business, like no business I know.
Yes, that is us, the sanguines, the partiers, show business. Okay, let me say one thing. I'm really serious on the tapes. Okay. I really do teach. But, you know, I believe these things are gatherings for us in order to get to know each other and to enjoy each other and to fellowship, because it doesn't happen very often, and tomorrow we ought to get to go home and be melancholies again. But they're the ultimate experts. You can put up the next one, Ephraim. There we go. Now, they're the drosh people, okay? Now, drosh literally means to diligently look for, to thoroughly expound and search, to explain. It's homiletic teachings. It's very personal. These are the storytellers, okay? When you interpret Scripture using a drash, you bring it out personally. You expound upon it and you elaborate on it. That's what sanguines do. We always exaggerate everything, okay? And we need exaggerated compliments, too. You don't have to. We're the fun people. We're the ultimate extroverts. We're optimists. We love the limelight and attention. We're the talkers, the entertainers, spirited, spontaneous, lively, funny, popular, and we think we are cute. Okay? Even our weaknesses. When you see our weaknesses, from our point of view, our weaknesses are cute. You know, there's really nothing wrong with our weakness. They're just cute little. Oh, so I forget. Okay. Okay. Now, but, here comes the bad ones. We're forgetful, we're unpredictable, we're naive. Okay, I could go into that for a while, but I won't. We're disorganized, okay? We're loud, see? We won't stay on the stage, we wander around. We're restless. I'm not restless, am I? We're scatterbrained, we're inconsistent, and we're undisciplined. Next. We want to have fun. We're really not concerned about getting anything really done. Okay? Getting something actually accomplished is not the point. We just want to have fun doing it. We are the Maynard G. Krebs of the Messianic movement. Okay? Work! Okay, we don't want to do work either. Okay? We want to convince everybody else to do the work, and we do that by over-exaggerating our situation. Okay? And we have to accomplish for it. Okay, next. Well, of course, we're the storytellers. We like to tell stories, and it really doesn't even matter if the story is true or not. Now, you've got a sanguine wife, and you've got a melancholy husband, and they're at a party, and someone comes up to him and says, you know, I understood that you two took a trip to Hawaii. The sanguine goes, oh, you wouldn't believe, oh, I guess it's a girl, huh? Oh, you wouldn't believe it. We got on this boat, and we got to the dock, and we got on the boat, and they put those, you know, big orange life things on us. You know, we had to stand there on the boat like this for about 2 hours, and then they served the most beautiful dinners, and all these people came out and just gave us everything that we needed, and there were dolphins skipping across the ocean floor, and the sky was beautiful, and we landed on a sunny beach, and then they turned to the melancholy husband, and they go, and what did you think to the trip? And he turns around and says two words, we flew. Only a sanguine could spend 15 minutes telling a story about a trip they never took. And that's kind of how we are. Next. We do not live for applause. Contrary to what you might think, we do not live for applause. Do you know why? Because that means it's over. Is that all right? Yeah. See, we live for the moment. We don't care if you clap or not. We're having a good time anyway, even if you're just dead in the water. Okay? We don't care. Next. Sanguines should always marry melancholies. Do you know why? Sanguines should marry melancholies because, you see, it really doesn't matter what kind of a partner the sanguine has because there's only one of them anyway. We are no good one-on-one. There's got to be a crowd, okay? So our partner really doesn't matter, okay? Because there's only one of you, and that's no good. As a matter of fact, one of the hard things, and I'm sitting in the restaurant with Sarah and Jim last night, and I'm seeing this constant crossing over of sanguine and melancholy the whole night. Typically what happens in these situations, and it happened to my grandparents when they got older. I just didn't know it would happen to you so soon. But the sanguine's trying to tell a story, and the melancholy keeps interrupting with facts. Is that not right? You're blowing this whole story by telling the facts. You know, got a melancholy woman again, or a sanguine woman and a melancholy husband, and one says, you know, I heard you took this trip. Oh, yes, we went down to Arizona. We left at 8 o'clock in the morning. It was 8:20. And we drove all day long. I thought we would never stop driving. We stopped twice, and we ate once. Well, okay, and we stopped somewhere near, and we stopped on the Arizona border at this place. We stopped in Page. And we stayed in this beautiful southwestern adobe condo. We camped at the KOA. You know, and they're ruining this whole neat story with all these dumb facts, okay? We don't want them. Now, keep in mind, again, I'm going to reiterate, we can't help these things, okay? We're not out to get you. not out to ignore you. It's just the way that we're built. And we have to learn that this is what I'm married to. I guarantee you, those of you, Scott, Ann, I'm sure they've already done this. Your personalities, check these things out before you marry someone. Okay? Because our basic personalities are not going to change. Oh, we can change a little thing. I had to change dramatically in order to study the scriptures. Okay? Sanguines don't study. You know, they don't sit down and open the books and pour things. I had to dramatically change some part of my personality in order to do this. So don't forget the theme of this, because I'm sure some of these people are going to leave and go, you know, I never learned a thing, but it was funny. Okay? The purpose is to get along with each other and understand how we are. Okay? Let's go on to the next one. Sanguines are the ones with the tambourines and the prophecies in the parking lot. If you're a pastor of the church, the sanguines are in the front row with the tambourines, totally off the beat. Okay? Rod, you know what it's like, you're trying to keep the beat in the song, and there's the little ladies with the tambourines in the front row. And you're going, and the sanguines will also be out in the parking lot later to give you their prophecies. Okay? They've always got a word for you. Okay, next. We are, this is one of the most true ones. I told you, we don't live, we don't care about the applause. In about 25 minutes, that's what? Typical melancholy back there. All right. We are motivated by exaggerated encouragement. And you need to do that with your sanguine spouse, okay? When they do something. For instance, you come home and your sanguine husband has actually washed the dishes. Pour over him like he was a king. Oh my goodness, honey, I am just so pleased at what you have done. It is a beautiful job. Oh, I just love you for doing this. And if you do this, if you over-exaggerate everything, maybe, just maybe, in 6 months, he'll do it again. Is that not right? So keep that in mind as you exaggerate. You know, Carol and I I'm sanguine, she's choleric. And so we have our little battles now and then. It's frustrating for a choleric to have a sanguine around because of the forgetful part of it. So just not too long ago, we're preparing for a feast. And Carol spends, you know, all day and or all evening on this taco salad. And the next morning, we get up and she makes the mistake of telling me, okay, I finished the taco salad. I need you, when you come home, to bring an avocado home. She works in the oil field. She's a oil and gas inspector for the BLM. So she's gone all day in the oil field, you know, and I'm at home baking cookies and whatever. She's gone all day in the oil field, and she comes home, and not only did I forget to get the avocado, but I came home for lunch and ate the taco salad. Is there anybody that's had that problem before? Oh, I guarantee you, it's not good. All right, next. Again, we're not interested in learning how to do something. Why? Because the next time it comes up, we'll have to do it. So if we don't learn how to do it, sorry, honey, I don't know how. Okay? And so, again, we just want to have fun. We're not interested in really learning how to do anything. Next. We're not good one-on-one. I explained that earlier. Why is that? Not enough of a crowd. Okay? Not enough people. So we're not good one-on-one. And last. Usually innocent people. We're usually pretty innocent. We're not a plotting type of people. We don't plot. Okay? So if you think we do, you think we're out to deliberately get you, I can assure you we're not. Because plotting takes time and thought and work, right? So I can assure you we have not been engaged in that kind of activity with respect to you, your spouse, okay? We also don't hold grudges. Why? We forgot who it is that did something against us and what it was all about. This is the sanguine. Pretty good description. Okay, just for fun, and I don't want to take too long. We got three more of you to go, but how many in here would consider themselves a sanguine? Okay, there's a handful of us. All right, come on over to our room tonight, big party. All right. All right, Ephraim, next, the choleric.
That's when I fell for leader of the pack.
Okay. These are the people we need to organize this. Okay? These are the people that we really need. They are a disgusting pain in the butt, but we do need them around. Ephraim, next. Peshat, they are the Peshat people. Peshat, and the verbal roots of this is literally means to disrobe. Okay? But actually we use it in the sense of the scriptures as being out in the open, blunt, in your face, bold. Okay? Right out there. There, and that's where we get the concept of Peshat being the literal interpretation of the text. So the cholerics are the Peshat people, okay? They are the ones that will, you know, ready, shoot, aim. You know, those kind of people. I mean, just, you know, right out there with it, and they don't mean to insult you. I'm sure some of you have spouses that, you know, you stand there talking to somebody and they say something and you go, oh my goodness. They just insulted them to pieces. Is that not right, Carol? I mean, I'm sorry. They're the leaders. They're extroverted and optimistic as well, but for different reasons. Okay? Not the same reasons as the sanguine. They're the ones who get things done. They're very competitive. They're tenacious and they're strong-willed. They're resourceful. They're outspoken, confident, decisive. They're the chiefs. They're the presidents. Okay? And they're very productive. These are people that all the rest of us really do need. Okay? These aren't the people that actually plan something and map something out. That's the melancholies. These are the people that put it together and make it work. So these are the Monty Judas, okay, of the world. Monty is choleric. Are you not Monty? He knows he's choleric, okay? Monty's the one that will administrate and lead and direct and put things together. And you do this and you do that and you do this and you do that and I'll see you next week, okay? And that's how you delegate and get something done. We need these people desperately. Next. Next, they're bossy. Okay, now I should have prefaced this by saying, let's all make sure we can just ourselves and let's all get along here and don't get upset and don't think I'm looking at you when I'm saying this. Okay? They're bossy, they're unsympathetic, they're impatient, they're proud, they're domineering, they're argumentative, they're stubborn, they're crafty, they're tactless, they're intolerant, and critical actually shouldn't be there. Critical is a mistake. That's the melancholy. Actually, the melancholy is probably the supercritical. The choleric is only the critical. Okay? And we need these people desperately. Okay? Now, keep in mind, if you're sitting here right now and you're kind of looking over at your wife or kind of looking over your husband, and that's you. Okay? Remember, the purpose of this is to speak to, okay, not to your spouse. Okay? So you focus on what you should be learning from this and not how to straighten out your spouse. Okay? That's what we have a tendency to do is, you know, I could be a much better Christian if it wasn't for my spouse. I heard that all my life as a Christian. If it just wasn't for my spouse, I could be super messianic believer. Okay? You know, thinking maybe we get into heaven, you know, and God won't let us in because we didn't straighten out our spouse. Well, you didn't straighten out your spouse, so I'm sorry. I can't let you in. It's you that you need to focus on. Next. Okay. They think they are always right. Next. Yeah. All right. I hate to tell you this, but here is the sad facts. They usually are. You can always count on them to do what they say they're going to do. Is that not right? Their definition of teamwork is the whole team does it my way. Okay, that's their definition of teamwork. In their mind, there's two sides to every question, their side and the wrong side. Okay? But that's how they get things done. Next. Oh, by the way, one little negative thing. They're also resourceful enough that if something goes wrong, they can find a way to blame it on you. Sorry, Monty. They have a compulsive need to change things. Of course, the purpose is to make it better. They're always going behind you after you've done something and straighten it out after you've done it. When you swear in your mind that you were just about to do that yourself, and they just got there quicker than you, okay? That's how it is. That's what the sanguine's thinking. You know, I was going to do that. I was 10 seconds away from doing that when you just kind of marched right in there and did it. I can never get anything done because you cholerics, you know? And that's the way it is. They're going to give you, when they say, honey, I want you to do something, you got about 45 seconds. And you better get it done or they're going to do it themselves. And they'll remind you of it over and over and over again for a long time. And the Sanguins, of course, have to get it done within 45 seconds because why? They'll forget. So they better get up and do it quickly. Next, please. No rest around these people. Like I said, no rest around them. When they ask you to do something, you better get after it. You better get after it now. Next, don't have many friends. Okay? Yeah, if you're a choleric, you better accept the fact that people want to rest now and then. Okay? And so you're not going to have a whole lot of friends. Now, the sanguine, of course, and the phlegmatic are really the only two that have friends. Okay? The melancholy and the choleric, nobody wants to have anything to do with them. Okay? Next. As I said, these people need to be president. And you'll find that if you research the backgrounds, I have a lot of stuff on Lincoln because my family, both sides, it's a coincidence of my family, that both sides of my family, put it this way, my father's parents, the mother and the father both trace back to the same person. And so I know a lot about him. And I know that you research presidents, you'll find that most presidents have a choleric attitude. That's what makes them successful presidents. Okay, and then last of all, cholerics should marry phlegmatics. Okay? Very easy for them to get along because the phlegmatic doesn't care. Okay? But something needs to be done, so the choleric has no problem telling the phlegmatic what to do. Okay? And most phlegmatics don't mind doing what they tell them to do. Okay, now let's go to the phlegmatics. Easy going.
Did you ever have to make up your mind? Pick up one woman and leave another behind.
Okay. Next, these are the remezes. Remez literally means to intimate, to imply something greater, deliberately ambiguous, and it's used primarily prophetically speaking, okay? And the phlegmatics are very friendly people. They're very inoffensive. They're submissive. They're diplomats and mediators. Very peaceful, reserved, and patient, obliging, tolerant listeners, and very content people, okay? Very irritating sometimes on the tolerant part, you know? I think something. See, in my state, we have to deal with Mormons. We don't have any Mormons in here, do we? Any Messianic Mormons? Okay. They're just all going to progress to be many Yahwehs. Not gods. That's what makes them a Messianic Mormon. It's many Yahwehs. Anyway, you're standing there talking to just someone who's LDS, okay? And you've got the four personalities standing before the LDS person. The LDS person goes, you know how the LDS people are. But if you watch some of these channels, that we progress. From gods, or as man is. And the phlegmatic stands there and goes, that's very interesting. I've never thought about that. Well, that's very interesting. The choleric, of course, says, in this kingdom of yours, is there like a president god or something? Or like a head god you could be pressed to become? Of course, the sanguine comes up to the same Mormon and says, hey, is there any like festivals and conferences up there in your kingdom, okay, that we can go to? I can sing, I can dance, blah, blah, blah. And, of course, the melancholy goes, oh, I have to live a god. Oh, depressing. Okay, but there are some negative things about them. They're indecisive. They're reluctant. They're difficult to pin down. They're big worry warts. They mumble a lot. Uh-oh. You know, honey, you mumble all the time. You know that? They're compromising, and they're very doubtful people. Next, easygoing. Has a whole lot of friends. Which can be irritating, as I said, okay? So, because they're so easygoing and they really don't care, you know, honey, what would you like to drink? They can imagine a choleric having to deal with a phlegmatic, you know. That's one of the bad things about a choleric and phlegmatic. They want you, will you tell me what you want to drink now? Oh, honey, I really don't care. What would you like to go out to dinner for night, honey? Oh, I really don't care. Choleric goes, well, let's go to Sizzler. Oh, I don't want to go there. So they have an irritating time with each other. Next. There's something else going on with the phlegmatics. Like I said, you really can't pin them down. You know there's something going on in their mind that you really need to get down to what's happening in their little brain, okay? Because they're just so ambiguous. There's something else going on. Again, they're moderate Republicans fall into the phlegmatic era. Next. I don't know, and I don't care. Many of you I know are like that, okay? When's the rapture going to be? I don't know, and I don't care. Right, they're the Sergeant Schultzes, if you will, of the Messianic movement. And you'll notice we'll spend the shortest time on the phlegmatic, because they don't care anyway. I have found, go ahead and go to the next one. I have found that many husbands, now remember, be careful, be gentle. Many husbands, many are sanguines and cholerics at work, and they're phlegmatics at home. Okay? They're real aggressive, okay? Especially when it comes to danger. Okay? Men get aggressive when it comes to wars, sports, freeway driving, okay, and barbecuing. I mean, the man won't cook in the kitchen, but outdoors there's danger. Honey, stay away from the flames. Stay inside. I'll handle this, you know, and then we'll cook, okay? But otherwise, sorry, no danger in the kitchen. We're not going to be involved. You know, they're a nice phlegmatic guy until they get on the highway, you know. Now all of a sudden they became cholerics and sanguines, real aggressive out on the highways. And too many husbands come home and go, whatever you think, okay, I don't care, whatever you want to do. I'm home from work now. I'm home from the boys. I just do whatever you want to do. And that's sad. That's not good. I'm not bragging about that, okay? Because we need not be phlegmatics, okay? Except for, you know, around the house. As Monty said, when you get into that one room with the couch, party time. Sanguines. Yeah. Okay. Next. This is the one that I want to say to these two gentlemen here. That the neat thing about a phlegmatic, which should be for everyone, but I'm going to direct it at these two gentlemen here. They like you in spite of you. That's the wonderful thing. Because I know in this ministry that once you begin, I know people that have hooked on to Monty. And the things that Monty has done for him, and they've gone on, they've been successful, and then they just forget where they came from. But phlegmatics are true friends, and a true friend is one who will continue to stay with you in spite of your achievements. That's an important thing, and I didn't mean to get serious. Okay, it's just that I'm serious about that. Okay, next, the melancholy. Okay, next. Melancholies are the sods, of course. They fit the sods perfectly. Literally meaning to hide or to withdraw, to be deep or secretive or mystical. The melancholies are very analytical. They're self-sacrificing. They're planners. I've got charts and graphs and stuff all over the place. Okay? They're the type you want to get something done. They take out a pad and they start getting all these charts. And they come home and they got everything in files everywhere in the home. Okay? What are the melancholies? Don't care. That's a tough thing for a melancholy. Put something in a file? They're map makers. They're very scheduled. You see me up here playing the piano and singing, of course. That, you know, I'm not a real musician. Okay, you know, I mean, the real musicians are Beethoven and Clyburn and, you know, Madonna. But these are the musical geniuses, okay? They're idealistic, they're detailed, they're loyal, they're perfectionists, they're cultural, they're deep, they're geniuses. Next. But here's the negative things. They are moody, they're introverted, they're hard to please, pessimistic about everything. They're alienated, they're insecure, they're depressing, they're unforgiving, they're always negative, they're very mystical and withdrawn, they're extremely sensitive. Anybody in here know someone that's extremely sensitive? Did you see the way he looked at me? Isn't that the hardest thing to deal with as a husband? Did you see that man look at me? No. Are you going to do something about it? Oh, do I have to? Or you're at the restaurant and the steaks you ordered comes and it's not quite the way it should be. Honey, are you going to do something about this? Are you going to call the waiter over and do something about this? You just eat your steak and be quiet. Okay, on to the next one. Looks for things to be depressed about. I mean, it's not as if, you know, things aren't coming their way naturally to be depressed about. They got to search out, you know, something to be depressed about. Next. They're always in the healing line, folks. I come from a kind of charismatic background. Who would have guessed that? And I can tell you that the melancholies are always in the healing line. Why? They have no intention of being healed. There's two ways to get attention in this life, folks. The sanguine way and the melancholy way. That is to get positive attention or negative attention, okay? So it's the whole idea of getting the negative attention that keeps them in the healing lines all the time, okay? And like I said, they never intended to get healed. Or they did get healed, and they jump around for a bit, and they're back next Sunday with a different problem, okay? And we know all about these things. Next. Woe is me. woe is me, everything's wrong. You never ask them how they're doing. Never ask a melancholy how you're, hi, how you doing? Oh, you wouldn't believe it. My uncle got in a car wreck, and then all three of my sisters died the next day of leukemia. God, I'm sorry I asked. If you have a problem, theirs is always 10 times worse. Oh, honey, oh man, I have a headache, but I have cancer. Don't you care? Or the sanguine comes down after a night and goes, you know, honey, I tossed and turned all night long. Yeah, I haven't slept since February. So they're all, no matter, face it, just face the fact that no matter what's wrong with you, something's going to be worse than them. If you can do that, you can survive with the melancholy. Next. They are the great thinkers, as I said before. They're the musicians and the geniuses, the Einsteins, the Cliburns, Van Cliburns, who I'm talking about, yes. And they're the Beethovens of life. They are the great map and chart makers as well. Now, why do you think they are the great thinkers and geniuses in the world? That's right. They have no friends, and they have a lot of time to practice. They have a lot of time to do calculus, etc., okay? Because they have no life, okay? So they can spend it by themselves. Next, they're always suspicious of your motives. I know I hit home. I was sure I was going to hit home on a few of these, okay? They're always suspicious of your motives. Now remember, never be suspicious of a sanguine's motives, because he didn't have any, okay? What was your motive, honey? I don't have a motive. I'm just here enjoying the moment. There's no reason to be here. I have no motive. They're the why people, too, you know? I didn't want to go down to the store. Why? You know, I'd like to take this dollar and change it into 4 quarters. You do that? You ever know people like that? Oh, why about everything? Shut up. I know what I'm doing. Leave me alone. I'm a sanguine. There's no why to anything. Okay, last. Next. Or last, however you want. Is that it? Okay. One of the things I would like to sum up these four personalities in just a couple of scenarios, and then we'll let you go. Okay? And we'll close, and then we all got to go home. Forgiveness. Just using the four personalities with forgiveness, okay? The melancholy never forgives and never forgets. The choleric forgives but does not forget. The phlegmatic forgives. The sanguine never forgives because they already forgot what it was all about in the first place, okay? So keep those four things in mind. Now, I would like to just run over just a couple of little scenarios with you. When it comes to these type of personalities, there's a job that's being, you got a sanguine, a melancholy, a phlegmatic, and a choleric, and they're all in a place and they've been doing a job, and someone comes in and announces that the job is not going to be able to be completed, okay? The choleric's going to say, now see, the reason I'm doing these is by now you ought to have some kind of idea of what these personalities are like, okay? And what your spouse, and what your friends are like. By the way, when you leave here tonight, back in the marketplace, I have put 30 or 40 sheets. Actually, Carol does it. I do nothing. See, the sanguine takes credit for it, though. I actually did nothing. But Carol has placed back there 30 or 40 of these little sheets that you can take with you, that you can fill out and grab some. I admonish you, especially if you have young relationships right now, sit down with your bride-to-be or your new bride or whatever. Even if you're older, do it anyway, just for fun. And you fill out one, and they fill out one. And then you add them all up, and it'll see what kind of personality you are. It's a fun little thing to do. You know, it's not going to change your life or anything, but hopefully it will cause you to think about your weaknesses and your strengths. So the choleric, in this announcement that the job is done, naturally they would say, no, it's not. I'm going to show you. I'll do it. I'll take over right now. Okay. The sanguine is going to go, good. Let's go eat. Right. The phlegmatic goes, I don't care. And the melancholy goes, I knew it wasn't going to work in the first place. Okay? You got a church business meeting, and you want to build this big sports complex, which is, you know, pretty popular in churches today. And you have this big meeting, and you put all the sanguines over here, put the cholerics over here, put the melancholies over here, and you put the, who did I leave out? Phlegmatics over here. Okay? And you tell them, okay, now, in order to solve this problem, I want all of you in each of your groups to choose a leader. Each of you choose a leader. I give you 30 minutes, and I'll be right back. Okay? So 30 minutes later, organizer of this group comes over to the sanguine and goes, okay, have you all chosen a leader? Oh, we totally forgot. Oh, let's hurry up. Would you like to be leader? Would you like to be leader? Oh, we totally forgot. They go over to the choleric table, and they say, did you choose a leader yet? And says, no, we're still in an 8-way tie. The phlegmatics, of course, still can't decide, and they would like each one of them to be the leader. No, you be the leader. No, you be the leader. I don't care. You be the leader. No, you be the leader. Okay. You go over the melancholy table and you say, did you choose a leader yet? No, we got so depressed that 6 of us went home. I'm going to bag the last one. Did you learn something about a little bit about the personalities tonight? Okay. Do you think you can go home and have a little sympathy and understanding with your spouse? Okay, and not judge them so harshly, and not judge the brethren so harshly either, okay? Because one of the focuses tonight that I wanted to do was for us to focus on other members of the body, okay? Because what these gentlemen have been teaching us for the last couple of days is imperative before the coming of the Messiah. We are going to spend a lot of time together. And if we were moving as one unit, if we can manage to take time out of our life to love each other and to take care of each other and to understand our weaknesses and our strengths, then according to 1 Kings chapter 8, if we obey His commandments and we move as one body in the Messiah, the world will know that there is but one God. That's the promise of 1 Kings chapter 8. And as I told you before, if we can begin to drop our little messianic worldviews and work together to bring the whole house of Israel into the kingdom, then we will have accomplished our purpose. And I'm sure from the bottom of my heart that that is exactly what Yahweh wants us to do.
Remember to cling to your roots, that your days may be long, and that you will prosper in everything you set your hand to do. Till we see you next time, Shalom Aleichem.